Vectis Radio, FM 104.6. Our broadcasters are all ages and abilities. This is what makes us your local station. VectisRadio.com.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the movie review show on Vectis Radio, which is actually live this week. Hey. It's actually live. My name is Tosin, and I am going to be your host through the next hour as we go through what's on at the cinema, or maybe not even in the cinema, but you can watch it anyway. And it's like, you know, what's good, what's not, what you should bother with, what you shouldn't bother with. You might have heard them already with me, my intrepid cinema explorers. We have Sharon.
Hello.
And Sean.
Hiya.
Yes, and we have a bit of a bumper week this week, so we're going to try and get cracking with it, because I'm not sure whether it's just that there's more films out or whether we've just been nice and disparate and, like, you know, we've been really, really good this week about getting down to the cinema. But we have quite a few. I think we've got about 5 films. And if we actually make it through that, we have films that people had already reviewed and then someone else has gone to see, and we're going to see, we're like, whether we agree with their review. So a bit packed, isn't it?
It is a bit. Yeah.
Yes.
It's a bit packed.
Just a bit.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm not going to ask how you guys are doing, because we have films to talk about. Yeah. We have other things to talk about apart from, like, you know, niceties and all that.
About life. Let's just go with the fantasy. Yeah.
Let's get up. So, films that we have this week. We have A Wrinkle in Time. We've got Mary Magdalene, which we were going to talk about last week, but unfortunately, Sharon, when we recorded, you couldn't be there. Yeah. We've got Pacific Rim. We've got Isle of Dogs. And let's see. Annihilation, I've seen, and yeah, that, I think that's it. I think those are the films that we've got to go through this week. So, let's kick off with, I say, A Wrinkle in Time. So this is one that, Sean, you haven't seen this
I
one
haven't
yet.
Seen this, and I don't, it doesn't really appeal to me at all. I don't think it's going to be my sort of movie, but I shall wait to hear what you say about it, and who knows.
Did you ever like the Never Ending Story?
I've never seen The Never Ending
You've never
Story.
Seen The Never Ending Story?
No.
Never ending story. Yeah. Or that thankfully has an end, actually. Even though they tried to make some weird little franchise about it. Anyway, so A Wrinkle in Time. Sharon, could you tell us a little bit about what this film's all about?
This film is about, it's based on a book by Madeleine L'Engle, written in the 50s.
Yep.
One of a series of 5 books featuring the same characters. And the main characters are Meg Murray and her brother Charles Wallace and their friend Calvin. And basically Meg is going through a difficult time at school because her dad inexplicably just disappeared 4 years previously. And her dad was an eminent scientist who was exploring theories in time and space travel and multi-dimensions in space.
Yep.
Using a thing called a tesseract, which is a means of travelling between 2 points. Instead of in a linear, time being linear, they're saying if you can make those 2 points closer together, you don't fold time, you wrinkle it.
Yep.
So you can move vast distances through space and through time using the tesseract, and you can do it in an instant.
Yeah.
And one day her father, who was experimenting with the tesseract for NASA and for other agencies, just disappeared.
Yeah.
And then Meg, and, well, her brother Charles Wallace is who's much younger. Meg is like 12 and Charles Wallace is 6, and he is scarily precocious.
Yeah.
He has the mind and the speech patterns of an adult, so when you talk to him it's like talking to just a very small Professor Hawkins.
Yeah.
He's tiny and he has this understanding much beyond his years and his size.
Yeah.
And Charles makes friends with this strange person called Mrs. Watsit. And then through Mrs. Watsit, we meet her 2 friends, Mrs. Who and Mrs. Witch. And they are these creatures of the universe who embody light. They embody light and they can become anything they choose to be within the universe.
And then it goes off on this big, massive sort of universe-spanning adventure.
Whereas the Mrs. W's try to help Meg and Charles Wallace find their father.
I'd never heard of, was it Madison L'Engle?
Madeleine L'Engle.
I'd never heard of her before I heard about this film being made. But a lot of people, when they come up with it, they say the phrase unfilmable comes up a lot, because apparently the book is, essentially when they describe the book, it sounds like Interstellar for kids.
Yes.
Because it's also like deep sort of like physics and all this kind of stuff.
It's my favourite book as a child.
Was it?
Yeah, absolutely. A Wrinkle in Time. I remember But I remember the moment I bought it, it just captivated me.
All right.
I bought it at a summer fair at Shorewell Village Fete in 1982. And I remember I paid 10 pence for it. It was a second-hand book, and I loved it. And I read it numerous times in my childhood, and I read it again last year.
All right.
And I do a thing called the Goodreads Challenge. Goodreads is like Facebook, but for book readers.
Yeah,
there's about
I
3 million members worldwide. There's millions of people who do part of it. And I read A Wrinkle in Time last year, and it was my most popular book. It was read by over 800,000 members of Goodreads last year. Alone.
All right, so what do you think about it when you're thinking the book, right? Do you look at that and go, oh, that's because people have been saying unfilmable about that. But because I want to first of all what you think about the book as when you heard they were making a film of this, what did you think?
I was thinking, how on earth are they going to do half of that? Because it is a mind expanding thing.
Yep.
And the world you see,
yep,
you think, how would you visualize that? And the bit at the end when you meet the it, which is like the big bat.
Yeah, yep.
I thought, how on earth in a film, The It?
Yeah.
And some of the scenes leading up to the encounters with Charles Wallace and Meg with It.
Yeah.
And I thought, how are they ever going to do that? And so I would say it was absolutely unfilmable. And the medium encounter with him.
Yep.
And the journeys through the different worlds.
As a fan, what did you think of the film?
I thought it was... As a film on its own, I thought it was fine. As an adaptation of the book, I thought it was a little bit lacking.
Yep.
Some of the book weren't in it.
Yep.
So there's some key scenes where they hinted at, and I thought, oh, yes, they're going to do that scene, and then they don't. So they nod. They give a nod towards the book, but the scene where all the children come outside and they're all bouncing their balls
in synchronicity.
Well, the key thing in the book is one child is out of rhythm.
Yep.
And then you see this child who's out of rhythm with everybody else, sort of bundled away. And then you later meet him again, where he's like basically being reprogrammed or re-educated so that he gets back in rhythm with everybody else.
Yeah.
And so there's interesting ideas. And anyone who's out of rhythm on the planet gets re-educated or gets taken away.
Look, you see, that this is the thing about... Because I'm actually quite happy that it's like you're quite au fait with the book, because... I was watching the film and I've never read the book, never heard of it, anything like. And I was watching the film and I was thinking, something for me, the film doesn't quite work. Yeah. It doesn't quite hold together. Something seems a bit. It seems a bit disjointed for me because it's the touchstones, like the director Ava DuVernay, who did Glory and all that, and she's. I think it was a big deal for Disney to give this to her, because given a black woman in the current climate and everything, like they say, oh my god, they're giving her like a big. This is a big deal.
I think this is like the Americans' version of the Narnia stories in many ways.
Yeah,
has that place.
Yeah, and she's mentioned things like, you know, like things about watching things, a never ending story, and that's kind of human. And you can see that there's a bit like when they start going off on this world, like, you know, universe expanding tour, there's a bit of where I'm like, ooh. And there's a bit at the beginning where they go to the first world and they talk about, like, you know, her their father being there and the father exploring.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, and the world that they create on screen, I'm like, I can totally understand why you'd get lost exploring this. This looks amazing. It's really, really engaging. But then I felt like, okay, knowing that this was a book adaptation, it feels as if they went, okay, cool, we've touched that bit. Now we're in chapter 2. We need to get to chapter 5 and quick.
Yeah.
And then it seems like all of a sudden you jump and you're like, okay, we're here. What about that bit that seemed like it was interesting and going somewhere? Okay, we've chucked it. Okay, now we're here.
Yeah.
Now we're here. And okay, we're carrying on. We're building up something. Okay, cool. Oh, no. Now we've got to go there. Now we've got to jump. And it felt like as if they were just jumping around the book and picking pieces and set pieces, but it wasn't holding together and it wasn't flowing
absolutely
as a story on its own.
Because that's what I felt. Cause I thought, yeah, they've touched on certain scenes. Like there's a scene at the beginning of the book where Meg gets in trouble at school because she's like this angry, rebellious child
because of her dad.
Of everything going on, and then but they don't expand on more of what that has sort of her home life.
Yeah,
and then when they go to the different, when they tested the different planets. Again, they sort of touch on certain key things, like, you know, hey, I talk in colour. And you think, yeah, they make a point that they communicate through different ways in the universe. Each communicates in a different way. And then, but yeah, the whole thing a bit, when they get to the actual last planet, that is, you know, half the book.
Yeah.
And they've gone from the bouncing balls straight into the heart of the central intelligence. You think, about 5 or 6 stages they've just skipped.
Well, then it's even, okay, forgetting about the book and everything like
that.
Forgetting about it for a second, because that was one of the most striking images in the trailer, is all these kids out there with the bouncing balls. Mm. And in the film, I was like, okay, cool, what's this going to be about? And it's chucked.
It's about nothing in the film.
It has no meaning or no link to anything whatsoever. And I'm like, but why do you set up something that looks so great and do nothing with it? Yeah. So unfortunately, for me, there were bits about this that I really admired. I liked how crazy and how out there they were pushing it. It just wasn't linking together.
Yeah.
And I have to say, thank God for the adult actors, because I feel like there's two bits in this film that I thought like really brought it home, and it was down to Chris Pine and Gugu Mbatha-Raw, because it's just the reactions, like the kids tell them something. And there's a bit where Chris Pine's face is just absolutely heartbreaking when his kid tells him something. Like, the way his face just, the way he reacts, I'm like, oh my, that is a real moment. Mm. And the same thing with Gugu Mbatha-Raw towards the end of the film, I was like, oh yeah, those bits were in, because I wasn't that convinced with Storm Reid's performance. It felt quite one note, and she kept going on to the same tics. Like, she kept doing this thing with her glasses.
Yeah.
She kept pushing the glasses back up, and it just felt very, very, like someone had told her, okay, put that back on glasses. That's what you should. And it just didn't. Yeah.
And I know nearly everyone who wears glasses does that.
Yeah, but yeah.
Then she was doing that the whole time, and it's like, no, most people they do that.
We're on radio. Okay, so Sharon has just said that everybody who wears glasses, and if you wear glasses, you might find this, you push the glasses back up by pushing them up on the bridge of your nose.
Yeah.
But this is kind of like, you know, holding glasses on the side with between your thumb and your forefinger, and like pushing them back, and it just looked too mannered.
Yeah.
And although the guy who played Calvin, I was looking at him thinking, where have I seen him before? He was in that terrible Pan movie. He played Peter Pan in the last...
Oh, was he?
He was.
I recognised him, you know, and I was trying to think, I know he was like this sort of really sort of handsome young boy. I think, yeah, he's going to be a future heartthrob, isn't he? Well, and I'm sure he's been in other things, but I just haven't really registered what he's been in.
Thankfully for him, he's way better in this than he was in Pan. In Pan, he was terrible. And Charles Wallace, the kid that played Charles Wallace,
yeah.
Sometimes he works, sometimes he doesn't. He seems to work a lot better later on in the film when something happens to him than he does at the beginning. But I think I would probably give this a 2.5 out of 5.
Yeah, I think,
and I would probably be going towards a 2, quite frankly. Really?
Yeah. You wonder if there's a director's cut out there where there's much more to it. But I thought the Mrs. W didn't quite work for me.
I liked What's It.
Yeah, Mrs. Watson.
Yeah,
but again, she's not how you... Again, she doesn't look like Mrs. Watson.
This is what I think the whole thing is when you get book adaptations. Because sometimes when you read a book, you get a mental image of you know, what the character looks like, whether they're blonde or brunette, glasses, old, young, whatever. Then again, if you see a film, and then have you ever read a book after seeing the film?
Yes.
And then you actually have got the mental
them
picture.
Each, you see them. When you read them, you do.
But I think... that is where, and I've said this on numerous occasions, I think that's where Lord of the Rings nailed it, because for me, when I saw the film, the characters were how I pictured them in the book.
Yes.
So
it was almost seamless, wasn't it?
From the book. Yeah. So, and it was like, yes, you recognise these characters.
I think in Lord of the Rings, I saw the ring rates and I just thought, yes, they nailed that.
They did. They nailed
the ring rates.
But on a lot of other book adaptations, it's, you do sort of, that spoils it. I think it can spoil it in a way, because you get a mental picture of a character and nothing like it.
I've maintained for a long time, when you read a book, you actually direct the film in your head.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so when you see someone else's version of the film you've already directed, you're like, what? You're doing it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's wrong with you? So all right.
But yeah, I thought as a family film, because it's a PG and it's obviously aimed at that family market.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I would give it a 3.
Yeah.
But as for me, as an adaption, I'd give it a 2.
Yeah, I look at it and there's shots in this film I really, really like. There's bits in the film I really, really like. But I just feel like, as a story, they don't really hold it together. They don't tell you what the stakes are. I never got a sense of why they need to do this or why they need to beat
it. Yeah, or a sense of peril, really.
Yeah, never got a sense of peril.
In the book, you are like, ooh.
Yeah.
But again, I keep going on about the book, but it was... I remember sort of just being just loving this book.
You could tell you loved the book because you named the characters without even a second thought, without even thinking all that. Because sometimes in a film you can think, oh yeah, the character,
and the character
you
that takes you a while to think, what's his name again?
But you were just like this, doom, fired off, which is great. Yeah.
But I just loved Meg as a child because I read it when I was like 12, and Meg is the same age, and I was just like, yes.
Yeah, they do say that it's a strong. It's good.
It's a good. I mean, there are things about it because I know obviously the fact that the director is a black woman.
Yeah,
that's so. The problem that we have right now is that in the current climate we have, it's almost impossible to have a film made in a vacuum and judged on its own merits. So, A Wrinkle in Time is directed by a black woman. With everything that's going on in Hollywood right now, you're like, oh my god, yeah, this is so great. This is and so everybody, it's kind of like, you know, you want this film to work. You want it to, because if not, people are going to, you know, there's going to be someone's going to be like, well, we gave this film to a black person. We gave it to a woman to direct and look what happened. We did it. So, so we're not going to do that again. Give it back to the white man. So it's like, you know that that's going to, so you want it to be, you want it to be good. And I know that the fact that with the strong female characters in Meg, because she does sort of drive it, like when they're in peril, she's the one who sort of saves them and gets them out of it and all that. And the fact that it's played by a mixed race person is a big deal. It's like, oh my God, what was the last time we saw like a mixed race person being the hero in a big fantasy movie? And there is one moment, like there's a bit where she washes her hair, because she has hair exactly like my niece, and she washes her hair, and the way she sort of ties it up, that bit I was like, good Lord, I don't think I've seen that. I don't think I've seen anybody like with hair like that doing that kind of. Oh, it's just what this weird moment. I was like, I don't think I've ever seen that on screen, and I was just, so there's bits about it that I like and I admire. I just don't think it works as a film. And so anyway, we're gonna have an advert break.
Just 1 minute. What did you think of it, Shen Chao, and Star Wars? What would you give it? Because we didn't.
No, she did.
Did she? What'd you give it?
Yeah.
Family film. 3 as 3. A book adaption 2.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
All right, cool. We're going to take a little break now, get some adverts, and then we'll be right back after these.
Broadcasting to you from the Riverside Centre in Newport, this is your Vectis Radio, FM 104.6.
Welcome back to the Movie Review Show. And now we're going to crack on with this bumper edition, carrying on with the next film. And a couple of years ago, Guillermo del Toro, who has just won the Best Actor, Best Film and Best Director at the Oscars for a film that I do not agree with. But yeah, he decided, because he's a director that seems to just do whatever the heck he wants, and he comes up with crazy ideas. And he decided he wanted to make a massive robots versus a massive monster movie called Pacific Rim. And it didn't do as well as everybody thought it would and all that kind of, so it's taken a while, but now we finally have a sequel, Pacific Rim Uprising.
Yes,
and Sean, indeed. You went along to see Pacific Rim Uprising.
Yes, I did go to see this.
What was it like?
Okay, well, I guess you could call this, obviously, the Chinese must have been really, really involved in this, because basically it's a Chinese Transformers movie, really. that's what I would call it. But the basic premise is you've got this guy that used to be a Jaeger pilot. Jaeger, you know, they're the big massive robots
that they used to fight the big massive monsters.
And he sort of, because they've all gone, there's junkyards now and stuff, he tries to sort of steal stuff to sell. So he's not really a pilot anymore. He's more of a sort of a little bit of a rogue.
Yep.
And he meets this girl who's much the same, who's bit parts, odd parts, and tries to make her. She's made it like a small robot, you know. Anyway, basically, they get caught, and they get sort of they end up back at the training center. He's actually the father of the he's actually the son of
Stack of Pentacles.
That's the one. we are cancelling.
That's Idris Elba's character. Elba,
yeah, we are cancelling, which was actually mentioned in there. Oh, that great statement that he made.
We are cancelling the apocalypse. Which is the quote for the quote that will live forever from the first movie.
That's right. And in the meantime, there's this massive company that's been making drones. You know, robots. So they're robots, which are drones. So that if the crack opens again. The rift opens again. They've got these drones to fight them, a bit like Iron Man, you know. Iron Man's got one of them suits. Anyway, obviously, some of the same characters are in it, but the drones go a bit rogue.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of damage caused to whatever Jaegers are left, but there's a few left. So obviously, that's when it's a Transformers thing, and it takes a while before the kaiju actually appear, you know, the big monsters. So
yeah.
All the time you're waiting for these monsters and they don't appear until late on in the film. But on the whole, I really, really enjoyed it. So, yeah, I have to say, I would have liked to have seen a few more kaiju, you know, sort of certain things happen to the kaiju that, or the few kaiju that come out, they obviously sort of come together in some way, which is quite interesting. But basically, it is what you expect, big robot movie, you know, lots of action. So, if you've seen the original, there's not much more to say, you know, if you've seen the Transformers movies. But I would say, you could see there was so much Chinese money put into this. There were lots of, you know, the characters were all speaking Chinese and things, so it was, you know.
I don't think it's necessarily just because there's Chinese money in it, because I think if you're making a film called Pacific Rim, and it's supposed to be around the Pacific Rim.
Good point.
I personally would be annoyed if everybody showed up and were all like, you know, hey man, I'm from, you know, Texas, Alabama. I'm gonna know. I'll be annoyed if everybody was just American and it was I'm like, if you're Pacific Rim, let it be a Pacific Rim movie. Let me
But yeah, there's a lot of robot action. Rather than a lot of action with robots and not so much with the monsters, although they do appear at the end. And Japan, you know, features quite a lot as well, because Mount Fuji and that, yeah, that's going to be like the new, that's where they're going to come from.
That's because the first one they had this rift in the, I think, was it supposed to be
right in the middle of,
it was the
Ring of Fire, wasn't it? We were sort of around the edge. So
what's the name of that reef? Was it Great Barrier Reef? Was it
no, it was more the Pacific, it wasn't
near the Trent, near the Mariana's Trench.
That's where they were coming out from, and they might have sealed that at the end of the first film.
At the end of the
so
first
obviously
film,
to do a sequel, you need them to come out from somewhere else.
So, the first film.
I always thought the first film, for the premise, when you think giant robots, giant monsters, it wasn't fun enough for me. The first film, I remember watching it and not thinking, I was like, it's giant robots and giant, I should be having fun, but it seems like it's a bit more po-faced, it's a bit more serious,
a bit more tense,
like the film Cowboys and Aliens.
Yeah,
that sounds like a brilliant premise. That sounds like that should be like a popcorn chuck, and it isn't, it's too serious. And so with this one, is it more fun?
Yes. For me personally, it's more fun. As I say, I would have liked to have seen a few more monsters, but because that's what I like. I like the big kaiju. I always like the big monsters.
The design of them is awesome.
Yeah, you have to say that they're quite, you know, they are quite. You actually manage to see, you know, them a bit more. They're a bit closer up this time because you always saw them from a distance, but in this film, you see them slightly closer up. You know,
you always saw them from a distance in the first one, and at night in the rain.
Yeah, that's right.
Squinting through like a.
What is that? Is that a rhino horn? Is that, what does that thing got? Has it got a platypus tail? What the heck is that?
Yeah, but what does it look like exactly? But there wasn't any scenes with too many people running around this time. You know, like in all those.
Some of them, it's just like pointing,
You pointing to all the civilians to like peg it that way, and you've got people waving. You know, and you got police going. So there wasn't too much of that, because normally that comes in all the films. Go that way. Go that way.
Just run. Run. You extras, just run.
There's somebody going up going, Godzilla,
yeah. So there's not too much of that, which is quite good. And is it John Boyega?
John Boyega.
He plays the son of Idris.
Yeah, he plays the son of Stack of Pentecost.
That's right, Stack of Pentecost.
Unfortunately, his name is just Jake.
Jake Pentecost.
And Clint Eastwood's son in it, Scott Eastwood.
Scott Eastwood.
And so there's obviously, you know,
there were there many nods from the first film?
Rivalry. Yeah, they do mention that, you know, Idris Elba and his statement, they reckon it was one of the best statements that was ever made, you know. And so they mentioned him. So yeah, that's mentioned in there. I think it was because everybody didn't like that, did they? We are cancelling the apocalypse.
I love that quote.
You liked that one,
I
did
love
you?
That quote. I don't think it makes much sense.
As a
quote, I don't think it makes much sense, but I love it, and I love his delivery. Today we are cancelling the apocalypse.
I'm glad you liked that one.
In movie history, that is right up there in speeches that should be bad but somehow work because of the charisma of the person who's delivering
them.
It's right up there with Bill Pullman's speech from Independence
Day. Yes, I'll say this is
Today, we will not go quietly into the night. We will not vanish without a fight. No, today, we declare our Independence Day. You're like, that's a terrible speech. But yes.
It delivers, yeah.
Yes, President, now get in that plane and go kill some aliens. And it's,
Did you see the first one, Sharon?
Pacific Rim, yes. Mm. Yeah, I did. I liked it.
You liked it? You probably
had Charlie Hunnam in it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Sons of Anarchy, as he was.
Charlie Hunnam, beard, whatever.
Blonde, beardy.
Rides a bike, probably does some crime. I think Charlie Hunnam is, I don't know. I'm yet to see him in, I still think that the thing I saw him in which he was the most convincing for me was Queer as Folk, which was the first thing
when he was very young.
When he was very young. After that, it's like, I haven't really seen, I just feel like, I don't know, I find him a little bit vanilla, like just
he has done some interesting stuff like Cold Mountain. He was this sort of psychopath in Cold Mountain.
All right,
I don't even know who he is. I can't even picture him.
Sons of Anarchy. You didn't watch Sons of Anarchy?
He was the lead. No. He was the lead in the first Pacific Rim movie.
Oh right, okay, now I do. Yeah.
He's the lead. The one who has an issue. The one who ends up. The problem with Pacific Rim is that if you try and explain how everything works, you get into this sort of nebulous state of, oh yes, you need two pilots because they've got to drift together. This is what I'm actually interested in seeing one of the things you said, but I was wondering about that when I saw it in the trailer. I was like, why do they have a robot facing off against a robot? They're supposed to be giant robots versus giant monsters. Why? Yeah. What's going wrong? Who's not read the script? And I did wonder about that. So how many stars would you give this?
I would give this a 3.
Is this 3. A 3?
Yeah, probably a 3.
I think a 3 for a good, fun popcorn movie. I think there's a good, soft place in my heart for a good old-fashioned 3.
Just a bit of fun, yeah.
Essentially, look, if you told me giant monsters versus giant robots and told me it was a 5-star film, I'll say, what the heck is going on?
It's just a 3-star.
I'll be like, what? How do you get a 5-star giant moment, giant robot? It's like, what do you do? Is it like, does the robot stop halfway through a punch and start quoting Shakespeare?
I was going to say, is it King Lear in disguise? What's going on there?
All right, cool. And now we're going to go into a film that only I have seen. This is Annihilation.
Oh, yeah, I'm interested in this.
This is very interesting. And this film is one of these films that's almost more interesting. You know, we're talking about how Wrinkle in Time can't really be made in a vacuum. And this film is almost more interesting about how it came to us than the film itself could be lost in just the story of how it came to us. So it's directed by Alex Garland, who is known for writing The Beach, and he directed Ex Machina a couple of years back, which was one of those real sort of like head thinking sci-fi movies where you're like, oh my god, AI, and where are we going, how does this thing work? And it's just one of those films that you go when you think about for days and think, oh my, what would I do if I was in that position, what does this mean for me? And what does it even mean to be human? And so he did this film Annihilation, which Sharon, you said is adapted. This is adapted from
adaptation. Yeah, it's a best-selling book. It's a very thin book. It's not massive. It's only about 3/4 inch thick.
Yep.
But it's part of a best-selling, I think, a trilogy of books.
Yeah, I've heard that about it. And so this film was made by Paramount, the big studio, Paramount Studios in America. And they had the plan that it was going to be made, it was going to be rolled out, it was going to push into the cinemas and all that. Then when they watched the first film, the first draft of where the film came back, they essentially went, this film is too brainy, and we don't think we're going to make any money. So they decided to cut their losses and they sold it to Netflix for a whole bunch of millions, because they thought, we reckon we're going to make more money selling this film to Netflix. And this is where it comes in, that you think films are about entertainment, they're not really about entertainment. They're about making money.
Yeah.
So Paramount said, we think we can make money. Netflix said, you have a film with an all-star cast, a good director, we'll take that. Mm-hmm. And so it's been shown in cinemas in America for a short while, but you can't watch it anywhere else in a cinema. You can watch it right now on Netflix. And there's the whole debate as to whether that's a good thing, or you can watch it on Netflix, you don't have to go and pay the overpriced things at the cinema and all that kind of stuff. It's available everywhere at the same time, so that means that there's there's not probably going to be much piracy.
There's going to be, reduced demand for pirating.
Yeah, and this is like a massive debate that is going on at the moment at the center of the whole film industry. Where is film going to go? Are cinemas going to go out of fashion? And this film, I mean, it happened with the Cloverfield Paradox, which was released a couple of weeks ago. But this film, I think, just because of the fact it has Natalie Portman in it as the lead. It's like, you know, a big name director. It's a bit of a bigger deal. So I watched this film this afternoon on Netflix because
have Netflix.
I have Netflix account. Yes. I am one of the very, very million privileged people to get to watch this film. And I really like this film. And there is a bit of me that is quite sad that we don't get to see it in the cinema, because I think there's bits of it. It is very thinky. It is very like hardballed sci-fi. It's a bit like I'm going to go back to Interstellar, because I think Interstellar opened the door for almost sort of like bigger movies that you actually have to fix. You have to sit down and you have to pay attention to.
Yeah.
And go, okay, so what happened there? And then what is it? And this and
like Arrival. That was That was again one of those ones where you almost have to watch it backwards, don't you?
Yeah, well,
because it tells the story effectively backwards.
Yeah, you have to watch. It's like Arrival could. I think that there's more stuff that could come out with repeated viewings.
Yeah,
and I think with this film, this is probably where the Netflix thing might come in, because you can pause it, you can go back, you can go. It's the kind of thing where you'll be scrutinizing frames and saying, what is going on in that corner? What's going on in here? The story is that the film starts off and you have the Earth, and there's this, then a meteor strikes a lighthouse, and they just see this big, massive sort of almost explosion, and then it sort of jumps a couple of years into the future. There's this thing called the Shimmer that has covered an area and it's expanding, and they keep sending sort of military teams into it, and nobody comes out. Nobody comes out, and then one day one person shows up, and this person who shows up is the husband of Natalie Portman's character, played by Oscar Isaac. But he's different and he's weird, and people are not exactly sure what's going on, and she doesn't know where he's been, because she knows he works for the military. She's worked for the military herself. She knows he works for the military, but she doesn't know where he's been. She doesn't know what he went on. She doesn't know that he disappeared a year ago, and she just doesn't know what way. And so she's trying to, something happens, she's rushing into the hospital, then all of a sudden they get surrounded by all these government people, take them into custody, and she finds out, okay, this is what's been going on. And because she's a biologist, she volunteers to go in. And so they send in a group of five women into this gym, and it's all about what happens when they go into the other side and how things start going weird and how things start messing with them. And there's a whole bunch of things about the science of it, and they talk about DNA, and they talk about, oh, this is there, and they talk about things like ox cells, and for some people, if they don't like science and if they do not like sort of detail of how people figure things out in science, they might not like this film. But I think the clever thing that they do is that they root everything in a very human place. So there's a lot of questions about what are the kind of people who go on what looks like a suicide mission? Who is like, you know, they're scientists, yeah, but is the pursuit of science enough for them to pretty much risk everything? Or is there something else that's pushing them? And how does that actually work out? And then if it goes a little bit sort of psychedelic and a bit crazy, like, as to whatever this shimmer thing is it messing with their minds?
Yeah, as well as their bodies? What they see real in when they get inside, or is it something that they're seeing but is not there?
Yeah, and especially when they go in there, they have things like, they find things that the previous people who've gone in there have left, and they're watching it and they're going, what the heck is that? What is going on? And it's so, I really like this film. I think at the beginning it's very economical. It's not the kind of film that sort of spends a large amount of time setting up and, ooh, this happens and, ooh, that happens. I think very quickly, in 10 minutes, you're kind of like, ooh, I want to know what happens. I found myself like almost leaning forward towards the TV going, okay, all right, so
what happens about?
Next? Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. Cool. I really want to know what happens now. I really want to know what happens next. Right from the word go, it sort of grabs you in and it says, this is a story we're telling. And the final, I really, really love the final set piece in this movie. It's not like a big, massive, sort of like, you know, world-destroying thing, but there's a final set piece in the film. It kind of messes with your mind, and it kind of makes you think. So as you're watching it, you're kind of figuring it out as the characters are figuring it out. So you're watching it going, oh my God, if that's happening, that's what that must mean. That was, ooh, good Lord. Oh, sheesh. Oh, how are we going to get out of this? And so I really like the film.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I have seen bits about it, and I'm fairly certain. I mean, I could be totally wrong.
Yep.
But when you said about the shimmer, I'm pretty sure there must have been a trailer for it.
There has been a trailer. It's out on YouTube.
I seem to remember that, because I thought that would be... I'm sure I've seen it at the cinema, where, because it sort of glimmers, and you
it has a bit like a rainbow effect on it. Yeah.
So, but perhaps it was on YouTube.
Yeah, I've definitely seen it on YouTube, but I remember being aware of it in a wider context. So I was surprised that it wasn't coming to.
I think it might, because it seems pretty late in the day that they decided not to release it in cinemas. So the trailer might very well have been in cinemas. You might have.
Yeah, I seem to remember that, because I was thinking, oh, that looks a good movie. It was something I might look, you know. So it's very shimmery. There's almost like a curtain.
Yeah,
like a curtain goes across like a forest thing.
It's weird. I think it's a very good effect that they use, because it looks almost. It looks like someone's taken a piece of plastic, like a piece of cling film, and sort of stretched it, and then run a waterfall the wrong way up it, and it has this sort of rainbow theme because the light's going through it. I think it's a very, very good effect. Mm. I just think the creature design, because when they go into the shimmer area, there's some creatures in there. The creature design is brilliant, because some of the creatures are. Some of them are beautiful to look at, and some of them are horrifying. Some of them are just, some of the ideas that this film presents is just kind of like, we're talking about Alex Garland and with his, with Ex Machina, the whole, what actually makes us human? And all, he has all that kind of stuff. You're thinking, hang on, if that happens, what makes us human? If that happens, are we even human? If that happens, hang on a second, who the heck are we? So I think it's a very thinky film. I really, really enjoyed it. And I'm sad it's not going to be in the cinemas. I do not think it wouldn't have been a massive hit. A bit like, you know, Arrival. A bit like Arrival wasn't a massive hit. It wouldn't have been a massive hit, but it would have... But it would have been nice to see it on the big screen. I still hope. I hope that somehow we will do it.
I guess. Now with home cinema and stuff, and some big screens. So it's probably quite often. I often dream of in the front room of having like a massive screen.
Yeah.
digital projector to watch them all. So maybe that's the way it's going to go. I know there's lots of discussion.
Yeah, maybe it's the way it's going to go.
I do hope not, though, because I do love the cinema.
I do.
Yeah. You, that immersive experience, isn't it? Of just shutting the world out for a couple of hours is part of the appeal of going to the cinema, I think.
I just think they have better sound systems than I could ever have in my house.
Yeah, and you don't have people coming in and saying, you don't hear someone else's television, or you don't hear someone making their tea,
but then
the kettle
again,
on.
In the cinema, you do have those people with their popcorn and they're chewing with their mouths open.
Yeah.
Do you find that sometimes, I know there's a thing, do you sometimes find that it's more annoying than other times? Like when people...
Sometimes
something can just get you where you're like, I've
had some really terrible experiences in the cinema where people have just been so obnoxious.
Yes. I have had the endless popcorn that seems to start at the trailers and then not ever stop. It never seems to run out. And you just think, there can't be much more popcorn in that bag. And yet you find yourself waiting for every crunch and rustle.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, cool. We've got to rush on, but I'm trying to figure out Annihilation. I'm trying to figure out, I'm going towards a 5.
Wow.
On this film.
It did look interesting when I saw it.
I don't think it will be everybody's cup of tea. I don't think it will, but you know, a bit like how we watched Mother last year. Like it had all these
quite
ideas.
Quite divisive, wasn't it?
Yeah, it had all these ideas in it that you were like, ooh, what about this? And I feel this is like a science fiction bent. It's nothing like Mother, but it gives you that kind of feeling when you leave and you're like...
Do you think it was better than Arrival? Or same sort of thing?
It's different. I mean, I'm sure it will. It's a deep science fiction movie. It's female led, so there'll probably be comparisons there. But I think it's different. This is concerned more with a group than just one person, and I think it's less. Because Arrival could be accused of being a bit lovey-dovey and a bit schmaltzy. Yeah. It's less schmaltzy.
Oh,
It's a lot. It's less schmaltzy than Arrival. It's a lot. It's a much harder film.
Is there any action sequences in it? Much in the way of action.
There are some action sequences. Some of them which I think were actually inspired by James Cameron. They're not like to the level, but no. There's bits where there's one particular character I'm looking at and I'm going, were you in Aliens?
Oh, right, okay, that sounds good then.
All right, cool. So we're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back and finish off strong with Mary Magdalene.
Your community, your local station. We are your Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, and online at vectisradio.com.
Welcome back to the home stretch of the movie review show on Vectis Radio, taking you through to 7 o'clock, where Brian Curtis shall be in with the Eclectic Mix. Mm-hmm. Now we have, we always seem to run out of time. I don't understand. I always kind of like, why aren't you just talking about films? How can it take so much time? I really, really hope that people who are listening to us are not just thinking, oh, for goodness sake, these guys again are just banging on.
Just about get on with it.
Time, yeah. And in the spirit of getting on with it, Sean. No, not Sean. Sharon. Sharon, you're going to talk about Mary Magdalene.
Mary Magdalene, yeah. Maundy Thursday, so good for Easter.
Yes. Now, so Mary Magdalene, this is a film that I'm really intrigued by because it seems like the whole point of making this film is to redress the historical balance of who Mary Magdalene really was.
Yes.
Because, I mean, I grew up in an Anglican church in Nigeria, and I know that there was a whole... But when you say Mary Magdalene, people immediately... The first word people think of is...
Prostitute.
Yes. And when you actually grow a bit older and you get your own brain and you start reading things for yourself and you go, hang on a second, I think those are two different people.
These are two different people. Yeah.
so
I think, yeah, there's a bit of confusion around, and one Pope said, she's a prostitute. And then other people said, no, I think you've got two women muddled up here.
Well, I think the problem is that he was the Pope, so nobody said that.
No one said. Well, it goes into canon law, then that becomes, you know, be kind of, you know, all the Medes and the Persians can't be rewritten. It can only be... Another law replaced it.
So, Mary Magdalene. So I'm happy that this film exists, personally.
Yes.
Let me just put it that way.
I want to see it because it's an intriguing premise. Because, yeah. Again, you think, you know, the women in the Bible play a really important part in the gospel story. Because, you know, they're there at the beginning.
Yep.
And they were there at the end. And the first people who saw the risen Jesus were Mary Magdalene. And, you know, and they went and got the disciples and said, look, this is what I've seen. Come and get them. And yep. So it was... The women play an important role in that whole gospel story. And this basically tries to redress that. But it's you see it all from Mary Magdalene's point of view. So you see her home environment, how she's living with her family, you know, in the one sort of big, in this village by the lake, Lake Galilee.
Yep.
And, you know, she's like her it's very I can't remember the word now, it's gone, but it's very sort of male dominant society, like her father is the head of the house, patriarchal, that's the yep. one, and then it's like her older brothers, and then her older brother's wife takes precedent over her, then her next brother, then his wife takes, and so basically as a single woman left in the household, she's right at the bottom of the pecking order basically.
Yeah.
And the pressure on her is to be married, that if you're not married, you have no status.
Yeah.
As a single daughter, you are little more than a burden on the household. And she feels that she wants more than, in the story, in the film, you know, she feels torn. She doesn't want to be just to slot in and marry. They keep sort of pushing this, all these suitors at her, saying, I think you should marry him and you should marry him. And it's like, no. And so one day she goes and she sees Jesus preaching on the shores of the lake mm-hmm. to the fishermen. And then she witnesses some of that Andrew and Peter baptizing people, and she starts to listen to Jesus, and it speaks to her. What he has to say speaks to her.
Yeah.
And so she goes along to be baptized, and then she decides that she doesn't just want to listen to him, she wants to be a disciple. She wants to go with Jesus and his disciples to Jerusalem and to follow him the way another disciple would. And they say, well, if you do that, people will think you're a loose woman.
Yeah.
And she'll say, no, I'm going as a disciple. I want to, his work, I want to do, you know, what he says, and I want to be with him and the other disciples as a disciple. I'm not there as their servant. I'm not there as their anything. I'm there as purely as a disciple, the same as everybody else.
Yeah.
And so and then you see it leads up to the Last Supper and then the betrayal and then the crucifixion of Jesus and then the resurrection as well. It takes you through the whole Easter story.
Oh, cool.
So it's
from her point of view.
From her point of view. Mm. It's in many, so that's the film.
Yeah.
And then there's the critique of the film.
Okay.
The whole palette, the colour palette is very subdued.
Yep.
So everything's sort of grey, the sky's always grey, and it seems like slightly overcast, all the characters are wearing, there's like these really sort of bleached, subdued colours. Everything is quite subdued, and the tone of the film is very underplayed. Yep. Like every scene is underplayed, even things like the baptisms, where in the old biblical epics, it was like in the Technicolor, you know, the greatest story ever told. Everything's like these really deep, rich colours. And then you do get the sort of the dove descending from heaven and the voice saying, "Oh, this is my son." And you get the, whoa, the heavenly music.
I seem to remember.
There's none of that in this.
I seem to remember, actually, it's quite funny, that you remember the Ladybird books? You know the Ladybird books? I'm sure when I was younger, there was like one called The Easter Story.
Yes,
and that was
there
very, the actual pictures were, whereas normally they were quite vibrant colours, in this Easter Story, I seem to remember it as being quite, almost sepia, you know what I mean? There was not much colour. It's very bleached, very washed out.
Well, the thing about it is, because the approach that this film seems to have, all the things I've seen about it, remember, we haven't done it for ages, like a podcast. We used to do a podcast called They Don't Make Them Like They Used To.
Yes.
And there was a time when we spoke about a film called The Gospel According to Mark, which was made in black and white, but came from a very sort of realistic point of view, a realistic point of telling of the gospel. So it was like, okay, let's look, this Jesus was a man, and let's try and focus on what it would have been to have like this man around who was doing all these things, as opposed to egging the pudding and going, oh, look, oh, it's he's God. It feels like this film, because the trailers I've seen and shots of it I've seen, it looks like they're trying to make as close to a black and white movie as you can,
yes,
but in colour.
Yes, they stripped all even the Roman soldiers, they're like scarlet tunics are like a really dull red.
Yeah.
And there's no sort of splashes of colour in it. It's a real subdued colour palette. It's all sort of like low...
I'll be willing to bet that the director is a massive fan of The Gospel According to Mark.
Yeah. That makes more sense, actually, because some of the scenes where where she's wearing like her just unbleached tunics and stuff, all the cottons are undyed, they're all unbleached, they're like home woven fabrics and stuff. And so, yeah, because of the colour palette is really subdued, you feel quite subdued watching it. You lose that sense of wonder in some way. So when you sort of see her conversion, if you were, for want of a better word, it's really underwhelming. And you're thinking, this is a life-transforming moment, but you don't always see that.
Well, it's actually quite like that.
Yeah.
I quite like that approach to it, because I mean,
because you want that balance between, you want to see their sense of wonder and thinking, actually, this man is not any other man.
Yeah,
but then you lose a little bit of the wonder, because it's all a bit like, yeah, that bloke, he's all right.
Yeah, no, but the thing is, okay, so I used to work for a church. Work for a church, and I'm a Christian, and you see, well, if essentially, people want this big kind of showbiz, show me the money kind of thing. And so everybody wants the story about, oh, how did you become a Christian? Well, I was driving down one road and then the clouds parted and the sun came out and there was a beam of light and I heard God saying, turn around.
Yeah,
and
they want to hear that Damascus road, don't they?
And then I physically turned the car around. And when I did, I felt my life was going in a totally different direction because I was going back where I... And people want that sort of story.
Yeah.
Which, quite frankly, I look at it and I think, look, majority of people
don't have that experience.
Yes, majority of people, it looks totally underwhelming.
Yeah.
And I think it looks like, oh yeah, it's just Tuesday.
Yeah, and so, it is hard to, I imagine it is hard to film real faith, because it just looks...
Yeah.
What do you look like when you have a moment of revelation?
Is that what they call an epiphany?
An epiphany,
Epiphany is not particularly visual. I mean...
No, it's that inner experience of saying, actually, yes, I believe is what they...
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's some good things about it. And I do like the fact that it tried to sort of show Mary as someone who was prepared to give up everything to follow Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the first person to see, you know, the risen Jesus.
Yeah.
And then, but they did sort of tweak bits in that we know from the gospel accounts.
Yeah.
So part of me was thinking, why did you feel the need to tweak that to make it in her favour more?
Well, it's Hollywood.
It's Hollywood. But there's just sort of little things to me that real niggled, was like the fact that they shows that her being baptised by Jesus. And I'm like, you know, Jesus didn't baptize anyone because he didn't want anyone to say, hey, my baptism is better than yours because Jesus baptized me and you were only done by a disciple.
Oh, yeah, that's
so
a good point.
Only the disciples ever baptized. Jesus never ever baptized. And so, but he's physically baptizing Mary.
Okay.
So is he like the Jesus you perceive with the long hair and the
it's long hair and beard, but it's a Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah, right. Once it's Joaquin Phoenix, that throws everything out of the window.
Yeah,
so
he's a slightly stoner Jesus.
Oh.
I've heard people say this, but the truth is, okay, we have, I'm going to say this.
Less than a minute.
Yeah, we're going to say this, then we have to rate the film.
Yeah.
Because people talk about the different gospels in the Bible, and they talk about, like, you know, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are very sort of like details.
Yeah.
And I've heard people, and I agree, they refer to John, the Gospel of John, as the stoner gospel.
Yeah.
because when you read the opening bit, it's like, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God.
And the Word was God.
Yeah.
He was with God in the beginning.
It's like,
I've read that so many times in like the Christmas service because everyone else gets in a twist, and I'm like, Shaman, you can read the God one, God, one John one, yeah, John one.
Yeah, there's definitely a stoner aspect. So how many stars would you give it?
I would give it again a 3.
Okay, cool. A 3 for Mary Magdalene. For me, I'm happy with that. I'm gonna have to put that on my ever-growing list of things I need to go watch. So, films we didn't get a chance to talk about, Isle of Dogs.
Isle of Dogs, okay.
We really don't have
that. Yeah, all right, okay.
We don't, but next week, because that was a preview screening, that so was. It's not released yet, so probably we'll probably have to have a show with Isle of Dogs and Ready Player One when that comes up. All right, cool. We are almost out of time, and we will see you guys next week where we'll be talking about some films, maybe Isle of Dogs, maybe Ready Player One. But you guys have been awesome. Goodbye.
Vectis Radio, FM 104.6.